vaccine A, the covert government experiment that's killing our soldiers and why GIs are only the first victim. We'll be talking with Gary Matsumoto coming up in just a second. I want to read you the central question of the book, and it's this: whether some sort of experiment is being done on our soldiers and eventually perhaps us, an experiment that had sort of fringe science involved, or maybe fringe is the wrong word, hopeful science. And that when it comes to a new anthrax vaccine or other types of vaccines too, for that matter, that things have been administered to American soldiers to make them a kind of giant guinea pig group. And then the question is, not only what would be the outcome of that, what happened to the soldiers as a result of this experimental vaccine, and even scary that this wasn't even the first time. We'll get to that coming up next on Coast to Coast, Vaccine A. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. All right, so Vaccine A is the name of the book, and there's a lot of history to this, as well as some very, very current events and some scary projections into the future. It's all there with Gary Matsumoto. Good evening, Gary.
Good evening, Ian.
Gary is a reporter for Bloomberg News and has worked for years both writing for magazines and other major newspapers. Let me ask you if you'll go with me on this. I want you to tell the story of Vaccine A, but I want to do it in a slightly different chronology than you tell it in the book, if that's all right, because
sure.
You've got great stuff here, and I love how you present the background to it leading up to the. But I also think it's important for people right away to understand the crux of what we're talking about, and that is, as you describe it in like the third or fourth chapter, that the central question here is whether what our government intentionally did with a group that they did not have to fully inform, or a group from which they did not have to get full consent. So if you had to boil it down, what would you say is that the number one fear of what the government did with soldiers at their disposal?
Well, Ian, I think one of the most disturbing things to emerge from my own research on this subject is the fact that there is only one population of Americans who can be experimented upon legally and without informed consent in violation of the Nuremberg Code, and that is U.S. military personnel. Under certain conditions, the United States Public Health Service, along with the FDA and the NIH, can run clinical trials with what they call INDs, investigational new drugs, on troops without telling them. And as you know, in the civilian world, if somebody gets sick as a result of a flawed medicine or vaccine, they do have the right to sue. You can't do that if you're in the United States military. There was a Supreme Court ruling that dates back to the late 1940s, in which it was decided that no one in the armed forces can sue the Department of Defense for damages or negligence. So you got a captive population here on which it is permissible to experiment, and if they get sick, they can't do a damn thing about it. Pardon my French.
No, it's okay, but there are good reasons for that, in one sense, that you've got a group that, if your intent is to do something for their greater good, you know, theoretically, you can give them an experimental or some sort of new drug because your hope is that it will end up saving more lives. And that's the rationale behind using an experimental vaccine, is the idea that they had to rush an anthrax vaccine both into production and then out into the field. This was being generated by a fear that if they didn't, there would be even more loss of life from people like Saddam Hussein with biological weapons. True?
Absolutely. In 1990, 1991, I was in Saudi Arabia and Iraq as foreign correspondent with NBC News, and as one of NBC's correspondents over there. I was a Department of Defense War Pool correspondent, and I was one of these guys who was embedded before anybody used that term. And when we were over there, there was one of the great concerns was whether or not Iraq had the capability of delivering chemical weapons and biological weapons with Scud missiles. And right. Every night the sirens would go off, and we'd put on our gas masks and suits and scrambled into the basement. And there was great concern that there would be mass casualties as a result of a biological attack. So this was a problem in particular when it comes to anthrax, because we had a licensed vaccine that was ineffective. In fact, it may have been at the time, and maybe still is, the weakest vaccine ever concocted. It requires 6 shots spaced out over a year and a half. Now, how many shots do you know require an initial one and 5 boosters?
Right. And the booster thing and how it was delivered, you cover the science of this beautifully in Vaccine A. But I fear going into that too deep yet, because I think that it's really important to get to it. But I just, even in framing this conversation, I want people to understand that this group, this control group, that not only has had this, did it happen then around the Gulf War, the first Persian Gulf War, but that you believe it has happened repeatedly, or at least there's evidence to suggest how often the government has done this kind of thing in the past. And we could even broaden it to include the Tuskegee experiments that they did on African Americans without their full and informed consent, except that, as you point out in the book, lots of these experiments that you would have thought were super secret were actually being discussed fairly openly amongst professionals.
Oh, yeah. It was that widely accepted. Some of the experiments that we now look back upon as unconscionable were actually done in the open. The Tuskegee experiments, where the United States Public Health Service allowed African-American sharecroppers to go untreated for decades when they had syphilis, just because they wanted to watch the progression of the disease. These scientists and doctors doing this experiment published their reports in open peer-reviewed scientific journals.
And the biggest names in journals. I mean, like, not obscure ones, the biggest ones.
Yes. Like the Journal of Bacteriology, mainstream journals.
Yeah.
The same thing with one of the most notorious experiments was done with hepatitis at a school for the mentally handicapped in Staten Island in New York, not that far away from me.
The Longwood School, is that what was it called?
It was called Willowbrook.
Oh, that's what it was. Okay.
And and some people might be old enough to recall that the expose on Willowbrook was the very first report that made Geraldo Rivera famous.
Right.
Back in the 70s.
I've seen the film, the old film of that. Where he looks like he's in the Hudson Brothers. He looks like he's in. He looks like he's in.
Yes.
He looks like he's in Three Dog Night or something. It's so funny.
But I was going to mention there this experiment where they were the parents were told that they had to enroll their kids in a clinical trial as grounds for admission into this institution. And they thought, or many of the parents thought their kids were going to get vaccinated. And in fact, they were just infected with live hepatitis B virus, because again, the physicians wanted to observe the progress of the disease. And the person who ran this test, he was full professor at New York University in the medical school. He was, again, part of the medical establishment. These practices were widely accepted.
Well, you draw an interesting parallel between those medical practices and those conducted by the Nazis in World War II. The only difference being is that at least in some of these experiments, you could say that the participants were volunteers, but you certainly couldn't say that in terms of Tuskegee. You can't say that in terms of that school for the handicapped kids. You can't say that in the case of the Army, and because in the sense that, you know, they don't have to tell. I mean, it's supposed to be for their benefit, but they don't have to tell people who are in the armed forces everything that's in some of these vaccines. And that's what you get into so well in the book Vaccine. We're talking with Vaccine A with Gary Matsumoto. Because it's not just the vaccine itself, but it's what they're going to use. It's the medium through which this vaccine is transferred. That becomes some of the culprit for Vaccine A. If you can, go over a little bit of the history of these delivery agents for how these vaccines are supposed to be used to activate the immune system in the body.
In the 1980s, there was panic over AIDS. There were projections at the time that there would be upwards of 25 million to 40 million people dying of an AIDS pandemic had our public health officials and physicians not been able to check it. All right, so there was talk of a 20th century Black Death. And this spurred a lot of research into a new vaccine to protect the population from HIV. Now, the problem you have here is that HIV, at the time, it was believed fatal. And a lot of vaccines, as you probably know, are made from the germ or the virus itself that has weakened. The jargon for weakening the organism is called attenuated. They cook it. They heat the germ up, and that weakens it, and it causes, in theory, a non-fatal infection, and that's what vaccination really is. People, physicians are giving you what they call a subclinical infection, and your body's immune response to exposure to the germ is what protects you from the full-blown disease.
Right.
Now, here's the question. What do you do with an HIV vaccine? Do you dare risk shooting somebody up with live HIV, weakened or not? Would you?
Would you take it if, I mean, it becomes a question of, is the cure going to kill you before the actual disease does?
Well, exactly. You know, see, this is one of the problems that they had with the polio vaccine in the 1950s. It was believed, based on data, as a result of the vaccination program, that as many people contracted polio from the vaccinations as they might have done through natural exposures. So there is great concern that improperly attenuated vaccines could actually infect large numbers of people with HIV. Now, if you knew that, if you're a patient and you knew that, or if you're, let's say, a parent, and the school said, well, we're very concerned about the spread of HIV, so we want all of your children to take this new HIV vaccine, and you knew that it came with it the risk of HIV infection, would you let your kid take it?
No.
Probably not. I think you'd have refusals from coast to coast.
Right.
So, and the flip side of this is the pharmaceutical companies would not want to take the risk because they'd be hit with class action lawsuits.
Right, right.
So this was an unwinnable scenario for our public health officials. And what they did was they embarked on a new vaccine development program where they adopted an interesting strategy. And that was they were just going to take a little snippet of the DNA out of one of these germs and try to create a vaccine just from this snippet. And that way, they thought they could create a vaccine that would not infect people. And if this strategy worked, then they could all of a sudden create vaccines to combat all of these incurable and fatal diseases that afflict so many people around the world, like malaria. That is a scourge of many populations around, right, around the globe. But you dare not inject people with a live malaria organism. So,
or you could create a bigger outbreak than the one you're trying to solve.
Right.
I mean, that's the conundrum for this.
Right. You know, this goes all the way back. The strategy of infecting people deliberately to protect them goes way back. And in fact, the very first time it was done in the U.S. military was in the Continental Army. Under General Gates, there was a rumor that the British were going to try to conduct germ warfare against Continental troops by intentionally exposing American troops to smallpox. So General Washington ordered the use of an experiment, what was at the time experimental, a process called variolation, and that is where the doctors sliced open a little bit of your skin, and they sprinkled crumbled smallpox scabs into it, and it infected people with smallpox. And what they found was that people did develop the disease, but a much smaller percentage of them died from it. So this practice goes back a long ways, and right, it's always a matter of the ends justify the means. We can protect more people, and unfortunately, some people will be sacrificed in the process.
Well, that's really what it comes down to then, is how many people, and we'll get into the specifics of what was in vaccine A coming up in just a minute, but how many people died? How many people were adversely affected by vaccine A? What do we know for sure?
Well, that is something we don't know. A lot of troops came back from the Gulf War complaining about mysterious illnesses, which were initially dismissed as malingering and then as a post-traumatic stress disorder. And than just superstition.
Right.
So no test has been administered to determine how many troops were sickened by this or have died as a result of these vaccinations.
All right. But we can know by what went into vaccine A that there were questions from the very beginning that this was a dicey proposition. We're talking with Gary Matsumoto, so coming up we'll get into the specifics of what was in vaccine A, why it was controversial, and what do we think the direct results were from this vaccination program, and how could this be misused again in the future if we don't stand up and say stop. Coming up on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. You all know the name Gary Matsumoto. He is now a reporter for Bloomberg News. He's a well-known reporter writing for magazines, newspapers, and writing the book Vaccine A, the covert government experiment that's killing our soldiers and why GIs are only the first victims. Just what went into Vaccine A? We've heard a little bit about how it was a splice. It was just kind of a nub off one of these germ agents, an attempt to sort of shorten the cycle of creating this vaccine. But what were the trade-offs for that, and what else went into that serum? We'll find out about that and just how it is affecting us now, next, on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. Gary Matsumoto and Vaccine A. And so we were talking about this vaccine that was administered to the troops and how it was kind of rushed into production for fear that Saddam Hussein was going to have these biological weapons at the ready. And that, in fact, really, when they ran the numbers at the Pentagon, they were looking at what they thought was the possibility of an aerosolized anthrax biological weapon that could kill hundreds of thousands of troops. That was the fear, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And based on most of the writing by military scientists, it was a legitimate concern. If you look at some of the declassified documents stemming from Desert Shield and Desert Storm, that was a major preoccupation of military scientists and doctors at the time.
And we did not have, not only did we not have any kind of serious stockpile of anthrax vaccine ready to go to give the troops, but there was even debate on what would be in it, how it could be done. England's army had a different version of an anthrax vaccine than we did. And the challenge had to be put out there that if we're going to do this war, or if we're going to be prepared for any biological weapon, we have to have, you know, the giant underground bunkers filled with this vaccine ready to go to give to the troops. And that meant hurrying production along at a pace that scientists would not probably prefer to have to a schedule to, for them to have to meet. But if you're going to do it, at least do it when you're using an army population that can't sue. So if you're going to have to do something like that, at least come up with a vaccine, you know, a rushed vaccine. At least you're giving it to a control group that doesn't have any control, right?
Yeah, you know, Ian, the situation at the time shows you the kind of moral conundrum the military is often faced with. Historically, more troops have died from disease than they have from bullets. I think the first time that changed was maybe World War II. And in this particular case, we knew, we had intelligence that told us that the Iraqis had been developing biological weapons as well as chemical weapons, and specifically we were very concerned that our troops would be hit with anthrax. Now, the problem you had was we were rushing the deployment of what eventually became an army of 700,000 troops halfway around the world to the Persian Gulf. And it was an extraordinary logistical feat accomplished by the United States military and getting all those people in the equipment over there. But the problem that they faced on medical terms was no one was inoculated against anthrax. It's just not something that they would have to contend with in a normal situation, right? The standard inoculations would be against the flu or against hepatitis or tetanus, but not anthrax. And so we had a vast army, an armada, on its way to Saudi Arabia that did not have any protection whatsoever against anthrax. And the problem we had was the existing vaccine, required about a year and a half to confer protection. And these troops were going over, they started deploying in August 2000, and we were at war by they were going over in August 1990, and we were at war by January 1991.
Right.
So there just wasn't enough time to get them protected against anthrax, and we didn't have the vaccine stockpile either.
Right.
We, you know, the facility, we had only one facility that made the stuff, and its production lines were down. So even if the vaccine would work on a short turnaround, we couldn't make it. So you had a really big problem facing the United States military. You know, military readiness means you also have to have your troops not only have to have ammunition and food and water, they have to be protected against diseases that they will encounter in a theater of operations. Now, at the time, Fort Detrick, where the Army has its research labs for the development of vaccines, had an experimental anthrax vaccine. They called it the second generation anthrax vaccine. And what they had discovered just a year before Desert Shield and Desert Storm was that in guinea pigs, if they shot guinea pigs up with this new vaccine, they got the same level of protection with just three shots in 1 month, instead of the six shots over 18 months required by the licensed vaccine. So the question is, what do you do if you have something that you think will work, something you think is probably safe? Would you use it if you are faced with the possibility of mass casualties from a terrifying weapon of mass destruction?
Yeah, if the math is, without this vaccine, they thought they might lose hundreds of thousands of troops. If with the vaccine, it ends up only killing, say, 10,000 troops or 5,000 or maybe just 1,000, if it only kills a smaller percentage, then it, of course, the math works from that sort of logistical point of view. But they, again, because you mentioned it was an experimental vaccine, they were cutting some corners on this in order to try to make these deadlines. And one of those things that you talk about are the oils that are used to help carry the vaccine into the blood system, and that this is a major culprit in the investigation of vaccine A.
Yes. At the time, it was believed that oils would be a safe vehicle. That was the language they used. It was a vehicle for delivering the main ingredient of a vaccine. Now, think of how you have to mix a concoction like this. If you don't have something that will evenly distribute the main ingredient through a column of water, in this particular case, it's the 5 cc's in a hypodermic needle, then you can't ensure that everyone getting a shot gets the same dose, because, you know, the ingredient might settle out at the bottom of a vial, some of it might get stuck to the side of the tube. So they wanted it to create a suspension made of micro droplets, each of which would carry a little bit of the germ. And they thought the oil would be safe because it was an oil produced by our own bodies. And the belief was at the time that it would be biologically inert. In other words, the immune system would not react to it, and therefore it would be safe. And what they learned after the fact, and in particular in the mid-90s to the late 90s, was that the oil itself was an immunostimulant. It elicited a very robust response from the human immune system. And as I guess we'll get into a little bit later, that's a very dangerous thing.
Right. Yeah. Again, we're talking with Gary Matsumoto. The book is Vaccine A. And so these things, this cocktail that they were putting together in Vaccine A, it was made, you know, with the best of intentions, with the best of the technology, with everything they had at their disposal. And heck, you know, you could even argue that to some degree it worked. I mean, we didn't experience massive loss of life from biological weapons. We assume that, you know, that we know all of the ways in which Saddam Hussein would have tried to have done that. And so you know, we can say that you know, maybe you can look at it on the main, if you're an optimist on the part of the government or on the part of the Army, and say it was an experiment worth doing, and in the end, if they had it to do all over again, they wouldn't do it any differently. But that you wouldn't, not everybody would agree with that, certainly not the people that were adversely affected by vaccine A.
Well, no, and that's the problem. If it depends on your perspective on the issue. If you're the person who's sick, then you don't like being a guinea pig. If you are the Army Surgeon General and you feel like you protected hundreds of thousands of troops and enabled the military to field an effective fighting force that was not crippled by disease, then you think, well, this was a success and it was a good decision.
If it was a success and a good decision, that puts the groundwork down for them doing that same thing all over again, which may indicate exactly what the government's disposition is on doing the same type of procedure in the future, either for the military or for the population at large.
Yeah, Ian, I have to express a great deal of sympathy for the Department of Defense here. There's a part of me that says, and I'm speaking as a citizen now, not as a reporter. I find the whole idea of violating the Nuremberg Code and injecting people with things without their knowledge, and then if they get sick, just basically tossing them aside and pretending like nothing happened, I find that unconscionable. On the other hand, the military has very reasonable concerns about having its fighting force crippled by disease. You may recall the great Spanish flu pandemic of 1918 that wiped out, it is believed, some 25 million people around the world.
Right.
They call it the Spanish flu because the first cases of it were reported publicly in newspapers in Spain. But that flu, the great pandemic, started with the Army. We know the index patient, the very first patient reportedly to come down with the flu, the killer flu of 1918, was a cook named Albert Gitchell. At Fort Riley, Kansas, and he got sick and he started sneezing and coughing all over the food, and that's what happened. A lot of troops got sick, and then they carried it the disease over with them to Europe. So here you have a disease that started at an Army base and killed a massive number of people. You know, 25 million, it's like an unthinkable number.
Right.
And that's what they were scared of. The military is afraid that when you get lots of people from all different parts of the country, like you do in boot camp, that somebody from New York hasn't built up natural defenses to germs that somebody from California or Oregon might have, but they're all thrown together, you know, at Paris Island or, you know, sure, Fort Benning. And these Army bases, boot camps, become an incubator for disease. So the military is always concerned about protecting the health of troops in order to ensure that we have military readiness so that we can put an effective fighting force in the field. It's absolutely crucial. So what do you do when you have some disease that, you know, that Private Snuffy Smith is not going to run into in the streets, you know, on downtown
right.
Dubuque,
right?
And you only have an experimental medicine on the shelf. What do you do? If it were me, I would take the same decision as the generals probably did, or as we think the generals did,
right?
Which is use it.
But in this case, too, maybe they were also getting an optimistic view of what vaccine A was capable of, or at least you know, for the scientists involved, they may have been fully convinced that what they were experiencing was going to end up being the end result for everybody else out there in the field, right? I mean, we don't think that anybody out there go, man, this stuff sucks. We better give it to the Army. We don't think that, but what was in vaccine A? Let's break that down a little bit more before we get to the top of the hour. Because maybe you need to discuss the difference between, this is going to be weird. This part's tricky. So everybody's got to, take a breath for this. The difference between squalane and squalene. Can we do that easily?
Well, you can if you're a chemist. I mean, I can't explain it to you, but you know, I think the important thing for the public to know is that they will both cause the same problems.
Okay.
So, you know, with different degrees of severity.
Okay, but squalane and squalene are what?
They are oils. Squalene, you know, you can say squalene or squalane or squalene. I'm not sure what the proper pronunciation is exactly.
There was no pronunciation guide in the book, so.
Yeah. This is an oil that commercially we extract from fish livers. It is a fish oil and is packaged as a as an antioxidant. It's sold in health food stores. It is an oil that is found actually in olive oil, and it's in our own bodies. There's a great deal of it found in our nervous system. And the problem you have with initiating an immune response against this oil is that it also then attacks wherever that oil molecule indiscriminately, wherever it is found in the body. And unfortunately, it's all through it's in the insulation around our nerves, and it's in our brains.
Okay, so I'll stop there to say, so what that means is by injecting it using it as the vehicle through which the squalene, using that as the vehicle for the vaccine, for the little bacterium that it's going to make you, you know, resistant to anthrax, the body also recognizes, or at least in a percentage of people, the body will then start to see the squalene itself as a foreign body. And in some cases, some people's bodies will then be triggered to attack squalene, which, because it's already in our bodies, it will create an autoimmune reaction, and people's own bodies will begin to attack themselves. Is that
accurate? That's right. It's an autoimmune disease. You know, the body, the immune system that's supposed to defend us actually then kills us.
And the trigger for that is vaccine A.
If you inject it, that's what we know it will do in animals.
In animals. We know it will do in animals. We see the people that were suffering after the Persian Gulf War. We can make a leap, a small leap. It's not even a jump. It's just like stepping over a crack in a sidewalk, I think, that if it's true that it does that to animals and that they're human beings that suffered, then we can say it also did that for human beings. Created an autoimmune reaction where their bodies were attacking themselves because of vaccine A. More on that coming up next with Gary Matsumoto, and just how that might affect us in the future next on Coast to Coast.